Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. This is Ryan Tripp of Return to the New Books Network. This is the History Channel. I'm here today with the Associate Professor of English at the University of New Hampshire, as well as the editor for the International Journal 18th Century Studies, Professor Sean Moore. Now, earlier this year, Professor Moore published his Slavery and the Making of Early American Libraries, British Literature, Political Thought, and the Transatlantic Book Trade, 1731 to 1814. And that book is the subject of the podcast today, again, out earlier this year by Oxford University Press. Welcome, Professor Moore.
Welcome. It's nice to be here. Thank you.
So, by way of introduction, what prompted you to study intersections between libraries, slavery, ideas, and possessive individualism during the 18th century? Further, why does the, quoting your book, sequential borrowing of works and the velocity of books circulating to patrons enhance the prospect that these records may be taken as documentation of actual reading?
Well, this project really began as creativity through constraint. I had done a first book on the Irish book trade of the 18th century, and was using a lot of archival material in the UK and Ireland for that. But by the time I was planning the second book, I had two kids under five, and my wife teaches like 75 hours at an independent school. So I really couldn't travel very far. It's like that commercial, not leaving home for a while, right? So I wanted to do an archivally based book on British literature. And I thought, well, you know, I could talk about how British literature was read in the colonies. I had a specific interest in looking at the novel as an import into the colonies and what I could find out about how people were reading British novels. That really brings in the possessive individualism part. That's really a discourse within the theory of the rise of the novel that explains why certain characters behave the way that they do. At the time, there was an economic conception of the self, and this had to do with the financial revolution of the 18th century and the encouragement of everyone to think of themselves as an entrepreneur. And so possessive individualism becomes a kind of identity that's marketed in the novel. So I wanted to see, you know, were early Americans, you know, getting this sense of what their personality should be from novels. And I was trying to put this together. And at the same time, my wife took a seminar from the NEH for high school teachers at Brown University on Brown University's relationship to slavery and how its endowment was created by people involved in slavery. And so I said, well, that must mean the Brown University Library was founded with slavery money as well. And then I was off to the races. I began to look at libraries, not only at colleges, but I decided to focus on these proprietary subscription libraries, which were all over the East Coast in the 18th century. And these libraries, as I discovered during my research, most of the people who owned shares in the library were involved in slavery or related enterprises related to shipping slave-produced goods or provisioning slave plantations, distilling rum, and that kind of thing, even shipbuilding. One of the things that that you can see with these libraries as I said, they are shareholder based. They weren't public libraries where anyone was welcome and could borrow a book. This was before public funding of education and libraries. That really doesn't come along until about the mid 19th century. So you had to basically be like in a joint stock corporation and invest in a library and own a share. These were elite libraries. Books were expensive at the time. And so you had to have some substantial income. And since the dominant economy of the Atlantic world was running off of slavery, that was how these libraries were built. In the process of researching the borrowing records, I was confronted with a problem that is epistemological in nature, which is, how do you prove that when someone checked out a book that they actually had read it? Here I was writing this book and saying, well, so-and-so read such and such a book, and that means X, Y, or Z. That's not always true. I explain this to people who use sites like academia.edu that sends you an email every day saying you have 3 new reads. Just because someone downloads your article or book does not mean that they've actually read it. The same thing applies to a circulation record from the 18th century. So one of the ways that you can help determine this is by looking at multi-volume works in the 18th century, and there were many of them. Novels in particular would be multi-volume. If you see someone checking out a novel like Robinson Crusoe or Pamela on June 1st, and they check out the first volume of it, then on July 1st, they return that and check out volume 2. And then on August 1st, they return volume 2 and check out volume 3. I think that's pretty commonsensical evidence that that person is working their way through the book. So that's how I am intervening into the study of readings, to say that circulation records can teach us much more than we have ever thought before. Another term I use is the velocity of borrowing books. This is when a book like Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations gets checked out and returned 2 weeks later and is immediately checked out by someone else. And then 2 weeks later is returned and immediately checked out by someone else. You can tell the popularity of certain books based upon how frequently they change hands. The term velocity of borrowing is borrowed from currency theory, which essentially maps how often a dollar bill changes hands as a indicator of how well the economy is doing, how well is currency making it into many people's hands. So you apply that principle to books, and you can see something similar, that these books are being read and are popular.
Why did you decide to focus on the proprietary subscription libraries in 18th century Salem, Rhode Island, New York, Charleston, Philadelphia? And what was their relationship to private libraries?
Private household libraries existed before these public libraries. There were also libraries that, a governmental house, like a state house, well, at the time, like a colonial legislature building, would have books for people mainly on law. So those were kind of quasi private libraries. The ones I think of the most are William Byrd of Virginia and James Logan of Philadelphia as big bibliophiles who had big private household collections. Now, what happened is some of these men who had collections of various sizes decided to pool their money in founding these proprietary subscription libraries. For example, when the Library Company of Philadelphia, the first of these libraries, was formed in 1731 by Benjamin Franklin and other members of the Junto, they got some books of their own that they donated. They consulted James Logan to see if he would supply any books and if he could recommend any books that they should purchase. And then they made donations and bought shares in the library that that funded the purchase of these books in London. And then were, you know, these were brought back in a ship that was owned by one of the members, one of the shareholders in the library. So basically, this begins with the libraries of people made wealthy by the economy at the time, who had private household libraries, and then formed these more shared, you know, proprietary libraries where everyone was an owner and they were able to get more books for each other's use by pooling their money.
Who was George Gardner? And what was the discrepancy between his 1760 purchase of John Hawksworth's anti-slavery stage adaptation of the 1688 Oronoco and the incomes of Salem Social Library proprietors, the latter of which derived from the slave trade and, as you've already alluded to, products connected with it? In your response, if possible, please also situate this discrepancy in the context of borrowing records for library holdings and sentimental philosophy and fiction.
Well, first I'll explain who George Gardner was. He was a young Harvard graduate and a student in the early 1760s. His father was a major merchant, Samuel Gardner, in Salem, Massachusetts. And I noticed that in a bookseller's ledger, Jeremy Condy's ledger from Boston in this period, that George Gardner had bought a copy of Orinoco. And I said, well, how interesting is that? Here's somebody in Salem that is connected to Harvard and connected to slavery through his father, who is buying an anti-slavery work. Now, this is not surprising to many parents, right? Many parents think that their children go to college and develop more liberal ideas than their own. And I think George was a similar type individual who was getting interested in anti-slavery, even though he was the son of someone involved in slavery. And this is where the theory of discrepancy comes in. This was recommended to me by a reader who peer-reviewed an essay I submitted to the journal PMLA. And this theory of discrepancy has a specific meaning in literary theory and has been put together really by Frederick Jameson and Pierre Bourdieu. Discrepancy basically means that even though you might have a dominant economy or some sort of other hegemonic dominant economy or culture, there's always going to be a counterculture in emergence against it in some sense. So Gardner was very much, George Gardner was in a kind of countercultural reading position towards his father's business. Once again, biting the hand that feeds you. You know, the fact that he was reading not the novel by Orinoco, but John Hawksworth's 1759 stage adaptation of this is significant because Hawksworth really was more part of the sentimentality movement of the latter half of the 18th century. And he was basically creating a very sympathetic portrait of someone who was enslaved, who was captured in Africa and brought to South America against his will, and what happens to him and his wife there. So this is a very sympathetic, tear-jerking play that helped create a lot of anti-slavery sentiment in London at the time. And so George Gardner sort of, he wanted to be in with what was happening with London culture. And this play was one way that he could get access to the emergence of anti-slavery as a tasteful attitude, as something that the refined person who has refined emotions should embrace, should become an abolitionist. So that's where the connection between anti-slavery and sentimentality as kind of countercultures to a slavery economy emerge. And the borrowing records for the Salem Social Library, which is which I investigated because George Gardner was from Salem and his slave-holding father was a shareholder in the in the Salem Social Library, which later became the Salem Athenaeum. That's why I looked at the library holdings for that, to see what people were borrowing. And Salem is interesting because in the same period that some other libraries were not stocking as much literature, Salem was stocking a lot of the latest novels and a lot of the latest literature, as well as more classical literature. So, you know, you can see titles that were popular in the 1750s and 60s, such as Eliza Haywood's Betsy Thoughtless, which was a conduct novel for young women, that was being borrowed quite extensively, even more than some other works. That would explain how George may have gotten access to some books when he was younger, and even when he was in college, is that his father might borrow some of these books for him at the library and let his son read them.
Why was Gardner's consumption of this anti-slavery adaptation, quoting you, simultaneously solipsistic for whites and potentially liberating for African slaves? And how did such sentimental refinement induce, again quoting you, white American patriotism?
Well, these are kind of mutually informing categories. On the one hand, there was a term that a professor, George Eliot Clark, a Canadian scholar, taught me when I was in graduate school at Duke. And this is the term borrowed blackness. And in this case, a young man like Gardner reading this, or you know, other patriotic young men who were seeing in the African slaves something in them of themselves, and even though these were free white men, there's a kind of appropriation of the status of the slave to argue for one's own liberty, and so in that sense, this is people reading the slave kind of identify with the slave in the slave narrative, in a play like Orinoco. On the other hand, slavery had always been part of English discourse, particularly in the 17th and 18th century, and it wasn't connected necessarily to African slavery. It was used as a kind of political category to describe whatever force was oppressing you. If you were, involved in the Civil War in the mid 17th century, you might view King Charles I as a tyrant who was enslaving you because, of whatever his associations were for someone rebelling against him. And in this case, of Charles I, there was always the association of a kind of Protestantism versus high church Anglicanism or Catholicism being associated with the king. And then, when you have a Protestant king, frequently, Catholics would view that Protestant king as a tyrant enslaving them and so forth. So, there is this political resonance that was also important to the patriots in the 1760s and 70s, slavery not just being considered strictly African, but also a kind of a native English political discourse or political term that was being used to describe the government.
Let's move to Rhode Island. You argue that the biography of Abraham Redwood and his Newport social network demonstrated Zizekian notions of charity and your conception of slavery philanthropy. Please connect this slavery philanthropy to your book's cover, as well as Redwood Library holdings in literature, entertainment, history, geography, and anti-Catholic narratives, one or all. And why was there an absence of explicitly slavery-related books? And how does slavery philanthropy inform present debates over the charitable industrial complex?
Well, the first thing I'll say, I'll begin in the middle of your set of questions, that it was strange that the Redwood Library's first printed catalog of 1764 did not have any anti-slavery books when the Library Company of Philadelphia had many of them. You know, part of that is because you had people in Philadelphia like Quakers. Anthony Benezet was an early shareholder in the Library Company of Philadelphia, and he was, you know, a principal abolitionist in America in the 18th century. And so why Newport would not have abolitionist books is strange. They certainly had travel books about Africa, about traveling and trading to the Middle East and so forth. But they did not have these abolitionist books. There may have been some circulating in Newport because in the mid-1770s, Samuel Hopkins, a Congregational minister, wrote an abolitionist book linking, you know, American white liberty and patriotism to the need to liberate slaves as well. But this was not really going over that well in a town like Newport. Newport was probably the most extensive slave trading port. You know, Charleston, South Carolina would rank right up there as well. But I would begin by saying there's some sort of cultural difference between the library members in Newport and in Philadelphia, Philadelphia being a far more abolitionist city than Newport. One of the reasons I thought I would connect this idea of slavery philanthropy that went into founding these libraries to some more recent discourses about the role of charity in our society is multivarious. You know, for example, I went to the University of Massachusetts in the 1980s, and you know, there was a robust support for keeping tuition low, and tuition has risen much higher than that. And part of it is our society has become far more oriented towards the idea that charity can supply all our private needs, and we just need to cultivate, more extreme forms of capitalism in order to generate the charity needed to support various organizations and the causes that they believe in. Zizek has a short video of a lecture he gave in England about this, where he quotes Oscar Wilde's Soul of Man Under Socialism. One of the things Wilde said, that the worst slave owners were those who were nice to their slaves because they kept the evil system going. And so, you know, there has been this larger scholarly discourse. Peter Buffett, Warren Buffett's son, wrote something in the New York Times, I believe it was in 2013, and I think he coined the term charitable industrial complex, and he was expressing frustration that, he found himself often in the same room with the people causing problems in, say, third world nations, because of attempts to economically exploit them, and the people who were trying to ameliorate those problems. And he began thinking, like, well, you know, is there another, is there a third way? Is there another way that we can think of solving these problems besides private philanthropy? And it's a very, you know, it's a very neoconservative idea that in the founding period of the United States, you know, we had the Tea Party, we had other events against taxation. So as we've moved to a more sort of a low tax country and low tax state in favor of, a more neoconservative 18th century model of society, there's the danger that we also move into a slavery society if we're not careful, because, a lot of these institutions that were founded with charity were essentially enslaving Africans in order to give charity to white people. So all I'm saying is that this term slavery philanthropy, explains a lot. And I'm not the only one working in this area. I think Craig Wilder, in a book called Ebony and Ivy, has examined the foundation of most of our early universities, including Ivy League universities. And without using the term slavery philanthropy, he is saying the same thing, is that people involved in slavery were the were the donors to these universities. They sent their children to these universities, who would then grow up to become the masters of these slavery businesses. So in short, I use this term to make the argument for more public accommodation and public funding for the arts, the humanities, and maybe return us to where we were when I was a student. Because even Democrats have embraced this kind of ethos. Not all, certainly, and I think it explains why you have people like Bernie Sanders doing so well in the polls, is that a lot of people are rejecting this kind of neoconservative political outlook, which comes from a certain kind of neoliberal outlook on economics.
Can you please connect this concept of slavery philanthropy to your book's cover, as well as perhaps to other Redwood Library holdings?
Okay, the book's cover is of the founder, Abraham Redwood. He donated 500 pounds sterling to get the library's first book collection. There were other people who donated the land on which the library was built and so forth. But Redwood, he made contributions to Brown University as well early on, when it was the College of Rhode Island, and even when it was, essentially endowed mostly by the Brown family. Redwood was an avid reader. He was a lover of all things English. He not only imported books and furniture, he also imported a English gardener named Charles Dunbar, because he wanted this gardener to design his Rhode Island estate along English lines. He was a big fan of English gardening as well. So many affluent Americans were Anglophiles, and they were in love with English tastes in everything and wanted everything that was new in England. And so Redwood was very much that kind of person. He inherited a slave plantation in Antigua. He had at least one slave voyage, probably several others, to Africa to sell slaves in the Caribbean and in other places. I think I've seen some manuscripts showing him sending slaves to Georgia and then giving orders to march those slaves north to South Carolina. So his profits were generated by slavery, and his entry in the Dictionary of National Biography explains that it was his involvement in slavery that made him the greatest benefactor of the state of Rhode Island in the 18th century. The book that he's holding is Alexander Pope's Essay on Man. The book in the portrait is significant. Methodologically, what this means for a book historian is that someone holding a recognizable book or being painted with books in the background that have specific titles on them, that should really, I think, count for evidence of the reception of a book. It is basically saying, I want everyone to know that I have this particular book or this particular set of books around me, and these books are part of what make me a refined person, but their contents to those who have read them also say something about me. And so what I argue is Redwood's reading of Pope's Essay on Man is a conservative reading, as someone who never freed his slaves, even at his death, because Pope's Essay on Man establishes the great chain of being where everyone has their proper place of subordination in nature and God's great plan for us. And that is pretty much consistent with the idea of saying that slaves have their place as well and should not be freed. It's a very much a very rigid class structure that someone who had inherited as much money as he did in the 18th century would gravitate towards. So by holding that book, he's basically trying to make a statement about his conservatism and his anti-abolitionist outlook.
On that note, for our listeners, please elucidate the passages and substitution anti-slavery strategies in Pope's 1713 Windsor Forest, as well as his 1734 essay on man, which the latter sort of lambasted Catholic enslavement of Native Americans and kind of highlighted that divine plan that you alluded to for African and African-American slavery. What further evidence exists of the reception of Pope's works in the British colonies?
Well, Americans thought of themselves as English Protestants and had the same prejudices against Catholics and had a phobia of Catholic powers like France and Spain. They eventually overcame these, it must be said. For example, there was a preacher in Newburyport, Massachusetts, in the Old South Church there, who in the lead up to the Revolution, in the early days of the Revolution, published a sermon where he was accusing the King of England of being a Catholic, which was a common strategy that borrowed from the English Civil War era. That you write something that is intended to create anti-patriarchal feeling among young people. And you direct that in that it's always figured in the English imagination in that period as the authority figure being a Catholic. That same preacher, though, after the Battle of Rhode Island, where Newport was rescued from British control by the French, the French come along, the French are Catholic, right? And so this preacher in Newburyport reverses position and says, well, actually, Catholics are not so bad after all. I think this is interesting because, Pope, though a Catholic himself, started out as a propagandist. I mean, if you were going to make it in literature in the earlier part of the 18th century, you really needed patrons. And there were various sources of this, certainly private money from, people like lords. And there was also money from Secret Service funds that would pay somebody who published a poem in favor of certain certain strategies and certain initiatives that the government wanted to bring about. And so Pope starts out with Windsor Forest, one of his early poems, doing that kind of propagandistic work on behalf of the Treaty of Utrecht that the government was trying to negotiate. This would end the War of the Spanish Succession, and it would also award, through international law, it would award England a monopoly over the transatlantic slave trade. And so that was something, it's called the Asiento. It would be ceded from Spain into English control. The English could ship to any ports in the Americas or around the world. They could ship slaves to do that, and they had a monopoly to do it for, I believe it was 30 years. I think it was 30. I think it ends, it gets revoked in about 1750. What Pope was doing in Windsor Forest, when he was talking about slavery, is A, like I was saying before, this is an internal British political discourse referring to anybody who is not treating the people well, but he's uncomfortable in talking, using that term when he is talking about the Treaty of Utrecht, because the Treaty of Utrecht was essentially bringing about English involvement in African slavery to a greater extent than had been done previously. What Pope did is he pointed the finger at the Spanish New World Native American slavery rather than to English involvement, and so he creates sympathy for Native American slaves and really just neglects to talk about Africans at all. This poem is, it's an English propaganda poem. It wants to, talk about the enemy who's the Spanish Catholic monarchy. They're still fighting wars of reformation in this period. When this poem and an essay on man are read in America, these attitudes get reinscribed and perpetuated, and I'm piggybacking on other work that has been done on the sheer popularity of Alexander Pope's work. An old book from 1949 discusses Pope's prestige in early America. Other people have written about this, like people like David Shields, for example, more recently. In my own research, I saw that Pope was the second most popular author to be borrowed at the Salem Social Library. If you just look at Rhode Island holdings alone, you can see that members of the Brown family owned copies of Pope's works. You can see that the early catalogs at Brown University had them. You can see that one of the first U.S. senators from Rhode Island, you look in his papers and he's citing lines from Pope that, you know, I only recognize because I teach Pope. I think other readers would not notice that. But my archival research basically affirms this general scholarly tradition that Pope was popular in the States or in the colonies, I should say.
So let's move. Actually, before we move to New York, how and why did critic Charles Gildon's 1719 review of Robinson Crusoe anticipate interpretations of the narrative as reifying prodigal disobedience and risk-taking in possessive individualism, especially after Crusoe establishes that Brazilian plantation and replaces his father as a patriarch over infantilized, to a certain extent, slaves?
Well, I bring up Charles Gildon, and I bring up both the idea of disobedience to the father and Crusoe's involvement in slavery, because usually in criticism, these ideas are held out separately. There is a kind of more religious interpretation of Robinson Crusoe. He does become converted to an evangelical form of Protestantism in the middle of the novel during his many years alone on the island. He is visited by an angel, and he basically has this kind of a very Christian experience on the island. And that's been discussed a lot. And Crusoe blamed the fact that he was on this island in the whole course of his life on the fact that he did not heed his father's advice and stay at home in England and become a lawyer or something, someone at the middle station of life, become an ordinary middle class Englishman, but that instead he ran away from home and shipped out on a ship and worked as a sailor. And so people who have done this religious interpretation, for some reason, have not mentioned that his first job as a sailor was in the African slave trade. So I think that these two things are connected. It turns out that I'm not the only one. Charles Gildon wrote this from the outset in 1719. He's talking about this in his review of Crusoe's book and Crusoe's disobedience to his father is out of the desire to participate in the slave trade and become wealthy through that. The question becomes for many critics, is Crusoe viewing his punishment at being isolated on the island for so many years, this punishment by God, is this a punishment for disobeying his father, or is this a punishment for being involved in slavery? And I would argue that that it's both. And Gildon said that. Gildon was someone who said that early on. Why are people talking about this prodigal disobedience when maybe he's being punished by God for enslaving other people?
If possible, please situate Robinson Crusoe within the post-Asiento and then the post-Revolutionary War history of New York, as well as the financial dealings of those West India men subscribers to the New York Society Library, the library's holdings in literature and political thought, as well as the early Republic reading network of this particular narrative. And again, what further evidence exists of library anti-slavery readership?
Well, I'll start with the last question. Library anti-slavery readership can be established by seeing who read a book by a former slave like Phyllis Wheatley, and then seeing what else those readers were reading. Book historians have recently coined a term for this. They call it mapping a reading network. So you look at the network around an individual book. These are all the individuals who may have read a particular book. And then you look at each one of them, who they were as a person, what were their business dealings, and what other books they were reading. This has been facilitated by a great database at the New York Society Library that Aaron Schreiner helped put together. And you can search the borrowing records for, I believe it's the 1790s and into the early 19th century, by the title of the book or by the borrower. And you can get this information. And so I have established in this chapter on the reading of Robinson Crusoe that of the 44 readers of Robinson Crusoe, 4 had abolitionist reading habits, and the other 40 were all interpreting Robinson Crusoe as a pro-slavery book. So this shows that the dominant way that Robinson Crusoe was received as like, this is a gallant young man taking risks on the high seas in order to make his profits and his way in the world. This is a form of entrepreneurship we want to reward. And so American editions of Robinson Crusoe in the late 18th century consistently call Robinson Crusoe in the title of the book, the story of Robinson Crusoe, that hero. And so, the idea that that people can interpret Crusoe's behavior in many ways, depending on what their values are, as with any book or any character in a movie or book, it depends. A lot is in the eye of the beholder. But in this case, the 40 beholders of Robinson Crusoe, I looked at their business involvement, and they were all involved in trade with slavery plantations in the West Indies and the South and other places. And some of them actually owned their own slaves in New York City itself. So Robinson Crusoe, I used to love the book. And after doing this project, I'm a little skeptical of going sailing these days.
What was the significance of fetishized slaves as real estate assets for South Carolina paper currency? Prior to the 1740 transition to chattel, and perhaps after, as well as the 1748 founding of the Charleston Library Society by planters and slave traders?
Well, with slaves as real estate during, counting as real estate before and not as chattels during the era of experiments in land banking, Africans essentially served as the assets behind mortgage-backed securities and the paper money that governments issued on those securities. So, you could have a land bank that was essentially the government. Well, not only the government, a private source could do this too. But it was real estate mortgages that were the securities that were backed by the real assets of, various aspects of a farm, slaves being one of them. And then after 1740, when slaves get recategorized as chattel, that relationship becomes more and more clear. Paper currency was a subject I've been interested in for my whole career. But the South Carolina version seems particularly compelling because they essentially, collateralize paper currency notes with slaves. And so, this involves a very complex understanding of transactions. But, basically you could the government would have their own slaves, whether those slaves were used in payments by individuals for each other in an economy that didn't have a lot of currency. Were these slaves banked by the government? Were they sort of used to pay taxes? Those are kind of more detailed questions I don't exactly know. But the point is that there was the government owned slaves to the extent that that they could issue paper currency on slaves as the basis, as the assets behind the paper currency that could be redeemed for.
How did Crusoe, the coin in the It narrative Crusoe, become both a slave to the owners and also a potential enslaver in transatlantic commerce? And how did this narrative serve as a monetary model for 1812 library subscribers in the Carolinas, such as slave trader William Boyd. And what about Eliza Pinckney's critical conceptions of Samuel Richardson's possessive individualist Pamela?
Well, first, I wanted to define it narrative. I think it was Aileen Douglas of Trinity College Dublin, who's currently the chair there, who coined this term, so to speak, in the early 1990s, and looking at Crystal, because John Stone, the author, was an Irishman. The narrative describes anything such as a coin, a banknote, a hackney coach, and various other kinds of objects that are basically personified as characters that circulate from owner to owner, and you get to see their adventures. And so rather than having, a character who travels the world, you have these objects that do, and coins, of course, do that. But the coin in this novel, Crystal or the Adventures of a Guinea, works as what critics of our Greek and Latin classics call a tricky slave who figures out ways of owning his master. The coin character is a fly in the wall, seeing everything his various masters are doing, and is therefore a spy reporting to the reader. This coin character was of interest to people who made transatlantic transactions, people like Boyd. So Boyd would be dealing in various currencies. And so it's kind of interesting that he would find this tale fascinating, because, he would be able to think about the various people who might own a piece of money, like a doubloon or something that he acquired in a slave transaction. Did this come from, South America, a Peruvian mine, perhaps, and then, make its way into his hands in South Carolina. And these coins kind of, collect, these characters in a way that they meet, and they're meant to be satirical. So a lot of the characters that Crystal the Coin meets are people of many vices, people who are not such savory individuals. And what it does is it kind of maps people's bad behavior when money is the only value. So what John Stone essentially is doing by having the coin be a kind of moral judge of people is to make people a little bit more skeptical about embracing money as the only value in a society.
Let's move to Pennsylvania. For the 1731 Library Company of Philadelphia, that you already alluded to, established by the Junto, how and why was the high cost of proprietorship and borrowing connected to the wealth created by slavery?
Well, this one was fairly easy to do. In terms of research, the historical methodology is quite simple. You look at who the shareholders in the library were, and the Library Company of Philadelphia has a shareholders book where you can easily see who the first founders were and the first shareholders. And then you go next door to the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, and you look up their family papers and to see, is there anything that we can learn about them? And you turn up, plenty of information quite easily. I was only in Philadelphia for a month, and I was able to find quite a lot that establishes this. For example, one library member was named William Fisher, his papers show something quite interesting. He took a trade mission from Philadelphia to Barbados and then wrote back to all of these individuals with basically the same letter, almost like a form letter, saying, I have sold your wheat and flour to here in Barbados. And so basically he would be selling these to provision plantations to feed people living on plantations, including slaves. And so that establishes clear evidence that, the farms of Pennsylvania were making their profits off of sending sending their products like flour to slave plantations, and Whenever I am in the West Indies and I see a Quaker Oats box now, that's all I can think of. And so Fisher writes back, says, "I've sold your flour and I've exchanged it for molasses and sugar and rum, which I'm going to send back to you." And so then that those products become a currency that goes back to Philadelphia that then gets sold and, you know, basically drives the economy. And so one of the things that's interesting about William Fisher's papers on this matter is that I identified everybody who he was writing, and they were all shareholders in the library. So what was interesting for that is like, okay, this explains why the Junto founded the library, not only as an institution of learning, but as something for the furtherance of business. So, I didn't find, you know, the evidence of shareholder reading is pretty scant at the library. I'm not saying that they weren't readers, but really a lot of times these libraries functioned as social networks for businessmen to make deals with each other and be a place where they could cultivate connections and with other wealthy people involved in business. One of the places you really see this most strongly is Alexander Hamilton visited with some members of the Redwood Library of Newport. And he wrote something. I don't know if I have the exact phrasing, but he said, I was surprised that they brought up no matters of philosophy. They talked of privateering and shipbuilding. And so that suggests that, you know, okay, so these libraries are not just about having, you know, a book club talk every Tuesday night. They're very much, almost chambers of commerce, you know, for these cities. So they're important social networks in that sense.
So hopefully they did read. And if most likely they did, how did historical studies, political theory, philosophy, Bildung's Roman fiction, anti-Catholic autobiographies, and travel narratives, one or all, contribute to Anthony Benzé's African Tracks, which, you argue, in turn substantiated Equiano's 1789 narrative and its sentimental construction of capitalism for a possessive individual aiming to overcome dispossession?
Well, the case with Anthony Benezé was interesting. He was a member of the a shareholder in the library company from its earliest days. He was really in on the founding of it, and he was an abolitionist, and he was an avid reader of many genres, as was Equiano. The sheer number of genres and characters and events that someone like Equiano can marshal in writing his narrative is really impressive. So with Equiano, we don't want to just think of him as a writer, but what makes him a great writer is he's a great reader. Yes, he's an abolitionist. Yes, he's a former slave. Those are important. But he had access to books. We don't know where exactly. But given that he experienced most of his time most of his life on a ship, the chances are he was reading ships, at ship's libraries. There's some downtime when you work on a ship, when it's not your watch, you have some downtime to read and there's not much else to do aside from other work on the ship. So I think he probably read on shipboard. In terms of possessive individualism, Equiano, he cites Benezé in the first chapter of his book, saying, "See Equiano's account from Africa throughout." Benezé had written a book called Some Historical Account of Guinea in the 1760s. And, Benezé had never been to Africa, but he had been reading other people's travel narratives, travel reports on Africa. And so he crafts a kind of image of Africa that where Africa is not seen as West Africa anyway, is not seen as a very foreign civilization, but a civilization that is actually quite Quaker in outlook, or perhaps Judeo-Christian in outlook and organization. And so he really tries to redeem an image of African society by selectively reading these travel accounts. And so Equiano cites Benezé, who, you know, this other avid reader, and Equiano was trying to prove that even though he was a slave, he was a legitimate English capitalist who deserved freedom. And he makes himself a possessive individualist character like Robinson Crusoe. Ramesh Malapeti, a professor at the University of Colorado, has recently argued that the main forebear of the character of Equiano as he constructs himself in his autobiography is Robinson Crusoe himself. Equiano goes through things like shipwrecks and so forth. He's writing an adventure story about his own life. He even mentions working on a slave ship. Equiano worked on a slave ship himself. Various other things that would really tie him into the reader's imagination of someone like Robinson Crusoe. So that's really what Equiano is doing and trying to create fellow feeling among his readers, saying it's unjust for this good entrepreneur to be a slave. And many people felt, you know, they were just trying to make a success in business and that, you know, they were being treated unfairly. And this African to them, becomes a sentimental figure. Equiano becomes somebody who they identify with and say, you know, I've been through what he's been through. This should be a free man.
Let's end with sales of Equiano's narrative. So in Philadelphia, how did library company borrowing records of memoirs, historical fiction, masculine voyage narratives, anti-slavery books, and Atlantic economy texts, one or all, help explain Thomas Dobson's purchase of 100 copies of the New York edition of Equiano's narrative for subsequent sale in Philadelphia?
Well, Philadelphia was an abolitionist city with many artisans who were drawn to rags-to-riches stories, like a slave starting as a small-time English Protestant capitalist and making it big. That's one of the things Jim Green, who's the librarian at the Library of Company, has published extensively on any number of the matters that about the Library Company in abolition. But he's the one who wrote the article on the most quoted article on the reading or the publication history of Equiano's interesting narrative in America. And so he establishes that this is one of the most popular narratives in the 1789 to 1791 period. It was reprinted in New York and sold quite well. It sold quite well, particularly among artisans, small-time entrepreneurs, craftsmen, who really identified with the story of someone who had been in Equiano's situation. Dobson, I recently, only a couple days ago, I saw Dobson cited in the papers of a Massachusetts man who ended up becoming Secretary of State. Dobson was supplying many people with books. There are a lot of papers detailing anyone who was living in Philadelphia. It seemed to, you know, in the late 18th century, seemed to deal with Dobson, anyone who was a reader, that is. Dobson anticipates that in a Quaker city, abolitionist city like Philadelphia, that if he bought 100 copies of the New York edition, it would sell well. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to find a further paper trail on what happened to those 100 copies. But I'm sure that if we looked in family papers for the 1790s, we would see people with a transaction with Dobson to buy the book. That would be a lot of work. But if you could find a few of them, you would be able to make a very solid case for that. But that's really the explanation why a bookseller could anticipate selling so much abolitionist literature.
So I have one more question. What can we expect from you next? Are you working on another project? Are you taking a vacation? What's next for you?
Well, what keeps me quite busy is all the work associated with being editor of 18th Century Studies. Having that on top of writing this book has been quite challenging. However, I want to push forward and keep working. I'm in a situation where in order to produce another book, I will need a funded project. So I have several in mind in book history. One would be another Irish book history book. One would be a literary biography of John Dryden, a book on his library and reading. I've also thought of expanding on this my discussion of the portrait of Abraham Redwood holding a book by discussing early American portraiture of people involved with slavery. And in those, in their portraits, are they holding books, and how did they get those books, and so forth? And do sort of a book on just a larger inquiry about portraiture of books and in connection with slavery. I'm thinking of calling that Slavery Books and the Making of Early American Art. So those are three projects that that I'm contemplating right now.
I hope you remember the New Books Network if any of those projects come to fruition.
Thank you.
So the book is Slavery and the Making of Early American Libraries, British Literature, Political Thought, and the Transatlantic Book Trade, 1731 to 1814, out earlier this year by Oxford University Press. Professor Moore, I thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you, Ryan. It's been a pleasure speaking about my work, and I love your podcast, and I thank you for including me in them.
So this is... been a New Books Network production for the History Channel. On behalf of Professor Moore, please tune in next time.